Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on April 16th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus update and Q&A on Facebook Live. Link to the video is in the show notes.
Hi, and welcome to this week's coronavirus update from Live Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanice, and I'm a health reporter here at the site, and I'm here to answer your questions about COVID-19 and what's going on around the world and here in the U.S. with the pandemic. I usually start out these live streams with a brief update with just case counts and articles, studies that we've covered from the week, and then I open up the floor to your questions. So just to give you an update on the case counts around the world, we're seeing that the case count is now beyond 2 million worldwide. And again, the confirmed case count does not actually reflect the true number of cases that have occurred worldwide, because we do not yet have comprehensive diagnostic or antibody testing. Antibody testing would be able to tell us who has contracted the disease and perhaps already recovered from the illness. As far as we know, worldwide, we see the case count is now about 2,100,000. And the number of deaths associated with the virus so far is up to 139,000 worldwide. Within China, we're seeing that up from about 82,900 last week, we're now up to 83,400. So again, especially compared with the very start of the outbreak, you can see how much slower the case count is growing now within China. Meanwhile, in the US, we're seeing that the case count has jumped to above 640,000. Up from 432,000 as of this time last week. So case count is continuing to go up in the US and will continue to go up as, number one, more infections occur, and number two, we actually have more widespread testing. On the testing front, we are seeing that diagnostic testing is increasing in the US. So between March 25th and April 1st, we were conducting about 110,000 tests a day within the U.S. Between April 8th and 15th, we were conducting about 151,000 tests per day. So this is a moderate increase. It is a good direction to be heading, but it is not yet to the capacity that we require to have a good handle of when we can begin to lift social distancing measures. State to state, it varies quite widely. City to city, it still varies quite widely. And you see a lot of both anecdotal and formal reports of people being turned away from testing if they do not fit certain criteria. So testing in general, in many places, is still being fairly restricted to those in healthcare. Other forms of first responders are definitely high priority for receiving tests, and those in high-risk categories. So the elderly, people with known pre-existing health conditions that could worsen an infection. These people tend to be placed at high priority for receiving tests. If you do not fit into those categories, at this point, there's still, depending on where you live, a likelihood that you won't receive a test right away, even if you think you have a fairly strong case. But again, that capacity is growing every day. The number of deaths in the US is now up above 31,000 nationwide. And in particular, we're seeing that New York State's death rate is quite high. As of Monday, April 13th, we were seeing a rate of 513 deaths per million people. This compared to California's 17 deaths per million. So this was a specific Live Science article that we wrote this week, if you want to look deeper into this. But about 70% of these deaths are being reported in New York City specifically. And there's a number of theories as to why we're seeing the death rate grow so quickly here in particular. So this could include that, for instance, keeping California as a comparison point, we know about less than a dozen cases that initially introduced the virus into California, from what we can tell from mostly travel from Asia, whereas New York received likely several dozen cases from Europe. So that influx of new cases might have sparked the outbreak in a more meaningful way. So we reached that higher death count more quickly. We also had an account of early on of a super spreader commuting in and out of the city every day and spreading it to communities throughout the area. So that's also evidence that perhaps that pushed the surge early on. There was also a significant delay in enacting social distancing measures, getting testing in place, and dealing with how to handle the virus given the varying densities of population within the city and varying access to healthcare and testing and requirements of different people in the city to come to commute in and out and go to work. So depending on where you live, you might hold different jobs. You might be considered an essential worker, and those essential workers might be mostly living in certain boroughs, etc. So these differences in density and traffic patterns are very important to a disease's spread. And in a very connected, busy place like New York, you're going to see a virus hop from person to person very easily. So those are some of the theories as to why we're seeing the death count in New York City rise so dramatically. An update for you on the symptoms of smell and taste loss that have been reported anecdotally in the past. So there were mounting reports of people losing their sense of smell and their related sense of taste early on in the course of illness, especially people with mild illnesses connected to COVID-19. So mild illness in this context, meaning that you might develop fever, you might develop coughing eventually, but you're still ambulatory, you're able to move around, you don't require hospitalization or breathing support through intubation or something like that. So fairly mild cases. A study from California has looked more closely at this and given us hard data that we can now look at. And they found that among a population of COVID-19 positive patients with mild infection, that about 70% said they experienced smell loss or taste loss or both out of this particular group of patients. So based on this study and this hard data, they're saying that smell and taste loss should be considered a fairly common initial symptom for a sizable proportion of people with mild cases of COVID-19. That said, fever still presents as the most common initial symptom for many people, statistically, from what we know so far. But this profound loss of smell early on in the illness could be a good sign for people with mild infection who feel otherwise well. And this is important because we know that people with mild symptoms are particularly influential in terms of spreading the virus to other people. Because if you're feeling well enough to move about in your community, that means you are a more powerful viral vector in that moment than perhaps someone who is bedridden with illness, who would be more dangerous to healthcare workers caring for them and family members living in the same house, things like that. So that's on smell and taste loss. There's also been an antibody study started by the U.S. National Institutes of Health. So they're aiming to recruit as many as 10,000 volunteers for this study. And again, to reiterate, antibodies are generated by the immune system in response to a new pathogen. So the antibodies are the body's defense system that recognizes some feature of a pathogen and is able to target that feature should the pathogen ever enter the body again. So these are really important to immunity against viruses in general. And if antibodies that are specific to COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, are circulating in someone's body, that would imply that someone has already been exposed to the virus and mounted some sort of immune response. So barring further data on how long immunity to the virus might last, we know at least that that person's been exposed already. So again, that study will include 10,000 volunteers, and those volunteers will first attend a virtual clinic visit for assessment, and then complete a health questionnaire in addition to receiving the antibody test itself. In the realm of vaccine development, we're seeing that some places are looking into the tuberculosis vaccine as a possible vaccine to repurpose towards COVID-19 prevention. And let me explain where that idea comes from. So the vaccine, which is generally known as a BCG vaccine, contains bacteria related to the bacterium that causes tuberculosis. So depending on where the vaccine has been created, what company makes it, it might contain a different bacterium. And in giving this vaccine, they find that it's effective against tuberculosis, but also that it helps people defend the body against other respiratory infections as well. So it might be responsible for mounting a broader immune response than just specifically that one bacterium. So in this respect, there's been some very anecdotal preliminary evidence that places that require that people get the tuberculosis vaccine in childhood seem to be hit less hard by COVID-19 at the moment. Again, this is very anecdotal and mostly theoretical at this point, but that's why you might see that people are now looking to tuberculosis vaccines to understand why this trend might be surfacing, whether it's valid at all, and whether this could be grounds for vaccine development going forward for a specific COVID-19 vaccine. That said, just to give you more background on the tuberculosis vaccine, it's thought that rather than targeting the adaptive immune system, adaptive meaning that this is the immune system that learns from exposure to new pathogens and learns to defend the body against them. Rather, this vaccine seems to tap into the innate immune system, which responds to insults more broadly. So it doesn't discriminate against different pathogens and target them very specifically with antibodies, but rather releases immune cells quickly in response to any introduction of a foreign substance into the body. So it's thought that this vaccine, quote unquote, boosts the innate immune system in that way. And in that respect, even though it's a vaccine targeting a bacterium, could somehow help people with the respiratory illness caused by this virus. But again, largely theoretical, and we should learn more about that in the coming weeks. We also covered a study towards the end of last week about how smoking increases your chances of having a severe COVID-19 infection. So at face value, we know that smoking, especially heavy smoking over a long period of time, causes chronic inflammation in the lung, causes damage to the respiratory epithelium, which is that thin layer of tissue that lines the respiratory tracts. So these, and in general, smoking over a long period of time dampens the immune system across the board. So it makes smokers more likely to develop viral infections at baseline. So these are all things we're also thinking about. But another study came out as well that raises the idea that smokers actually have more ACE2 receptors than perhaps people in other populations. And again, I'll give you all the caveats to this study in a moment. So in both the lungs of people who smoked over an extended period of time and mice who were exposed to cigarette smoke in studies, these researchers found that the quantity of goblet and club cells within their lungs increased depending on how much smoke they'd been exposed to. Now, these goblet and club cells, their job is to secrete a mucus-like fluid. And you find these normally in non-smokers up in the nose and upper respiratory tract generally. And the job of this mucus is to catch incoming debris, catch incoming pathogens. And in the nose and the throat, it's easy to get that mucus out of the body. Now, when things like cigarette smoke, other toxins enter the lungs, the body tries to defend itself by building more of these cells, which then produce more of this mucus-like substance. But way down in your lungs, it's difficult to get that mucus back out, which is the point of it, is to capture things and send it back out of the body. So that's where you might see that it's more difficult to breathe and you get that deep hacking cough. So with the boost of those cells, you also get a boost in ACE2 receptors, which the SARS-CoV-2 virus plugs into to infect cells. So the thought here is that perhaps if there's more ACE2 receptors present, the infection in the lungs could be more severe. This connection between the number of ACE2 receptors and severity of infection still needs to be confirmed with further studies. We're not sure of the exact relationship between the sheer number of receptors and the severity of illness, but that's one theory that we're looking at now. It's also not known if this increase in ACE2 receptors is necessarily unique to people who smoke, or perhaps common among people with chronic lung conditions more broadly. So these are all questions that we're looking at, but given that lung conditions and smoking are both fairly common comorbidities in the population, these are really important questions for us to answer, and they could give us clues towards how to treat people in general with COVID-19 and how to reduce the severity of illness. So I'm going to start answering your questions now. So I'm getting the question, do we know if having antibodies specific to SARS-CoV-2 translates into immunity to the virus? So at this point, scientists do think that the presence of these antibodies does correlate with immunity to the virus. But let me give you a better picture of what that really means. Antibodies come in a variety of forms, depending on what part of a pathogen they latch onto. So they are structured differently so that they can recognize different features on a virus or a bacterium, whatever the pathogen may be. So we're still learning about what kind of antibodies are generated in response to exposure to SARS-CoV-2. And the ratios of these antibodies, depending on their type, might be important to, number one, how strong the immune response is in terms of how effective it is at fighting off the virus in the first place. And also it might be important to how long immunity lasts. Now, what we know about immunity to other coronaviruses, to give you context, there are four common coronaviruses that use humans as their natural hosts, as their initial hosts. And these cause symptoms of the common cold. So we see them come back seasonally every single year. They don't mutate very quickly, so they're not changing their form rapidly. So in theory, the body should gain immunity to these common coronaviruses over time. But instead, what we see is that these seasonal coronaviruses can infect people over and over. And the question for these, again, these cause milder disease, but the question is, how are those viruses doing that if they're not mutating very quickly anyway? So that's a huge question for coronaviruses in general. Does this virus, upon first exposure, grant a person lasting immunity? That's an enormous question. Theoretical studies on the SARS-CoV virus, which is related to this new virus and also came from bats, suggest that people might lose immunity to the virus over time, similarly to how we lose immunity to seasonal coronaviruses. But because we haven't seen a resurgence of the SARS virus or the MERS virus, also related and from bats, it's unclear how long our immunity to this new virus might last. This is an enormous question, and we hope to answer it, especially in the context of vaccine development. Because even if you come up with a fantastic vaccine candidate, you give it to everyone, if our immunity to the virus only lasts a few years, that would imply that our initial vaccine would probably do similar if it works really well. And we'd have to figure out what's going on with the immune system that makes it forget that it's been exposed to the virus before. So that's a big question for if we want to be able to fight this virus off for a long period of time. I'm getting a question about, can smoking cannabis also make you more susceptible to catching COVID-19? So the study on smoking cigarettes that I mentioned earlier, the experts that I talked to about that study indicated that this increase in cells that produce mucus down in the lungs, this is not only common to smoking cigarettes, but any sort of, if you inhale chemicals, toxic substances, aerosols for prolonged periods of time, whether that be air pollution or any sort of smoke entering your lungs, any sort of contaminant that's not normally supposed to be there, the body defends itself by boosting the numbers of these mucus-generating cells. And again, these mucus-generating cells have ACE2 receptors on their surfaces. And the theory goes, if you have more ACE2 in your lungs, you might be more susceptible to a severe COVID-19 infection. Now, that said, everyone is vulnerable to catching COVID-19 at baseline. Literally anyone can catch this disease. So it's unclear if you having more ACE2 receptors would make you more likely to catch the virus in the first place, but it might make you more likely to have a severe reaction to the virus and require intensive medical attention. That's a fairly anecdotal point I've just made. There's not specific studies looking at cannabis versus smoking cigarettes. But given that you're introducing things into the lungs that aren't really meant to be there, you would assume the reaction to be fairly similar. Although smoking cannabis doesn't always elicit the same overall symptoms as smoking cigarettes does. I'm getting a question about how COVID-19 damages the heart. So there's a couple, we wrote a longer story on this, so I'd like to plug that here. It's a nice feature length and goes into more details of what's happening here. But there's a number of theories as to why COVID-19 might damage the heart. Part of this is simply because the lungs and the heart work in harmony with each other. So the lungs bring oxygen into the body and extract that oxygen from incoming air, give that, and also get rid of CO2, carbon dioxide. Meanwhile, the heart works to pump oxygenated blood through the body. So if the lungs have to work harder to get the oxygen into the body in the first place, the heart has to work harder to pump that oxygen around, and there's a lower quantity. So that's one big reason why COVID-19 might hurt the heart indirectly. It might also be that COVID-19 or the virus that causes it, there are ACE2 receptors present in cardiac tissue. So there's some possibility that the virus infects cardiac cells directly. This hasn't been studied incredibly deeply, but that's a theory that's going around, especially in terms of we're seeing a lot of patients present with heart conditions prompted by COVID-19 who did not have prior heart conditions. So people who didn't have heart problems before are coming in with COVID-19 and developing these severe heart diseases. And people are wondering why that's happening. There's also the chance that because of how, at least in a subpopulation of patients, how the body reacts to COVID-19 infection, sometimes it mounts this what's called a cytokine storm, which is just an extremely severe immune reaction, wherein cytokines, which are inflammatory substances that usually help the body fight off illness, get ramped up to a level that's now dangerous to tissues throughout the body, and it actually can damage heart tissue, but also other organs in the body. So we see this connected to rare instances of brain damage in viral infection as well. So that's another possibility of how COVID-19 could hurt the heart. What is the possibility of a second wave of infection? I'm going to assume you are asking about the U.S. specifically, but I'll answer this more generally as well. Until we have a vaccine, the chance of second waves of infection, in my mind, is pretty much 100%. Because we don't know how long immunity lasts in people who have been exposed to the virus. Everyone is vulnerable to infection. but not everyone has caught the virus yet. So as we're now employing social distancing to keep people apart and space out when infections occur, once at some point social distancing measures are lifted, there will still be a percentage of the population who has never caught this virus. So they remain vulnerable to infection. And we, again, don't know how long the people who have been infected remain immune to the virus. So in that, as long as the virus is still circulating, which we assume at this point it will continue to do, and we don't have a natural immunity against it, there will always be a chance of a second wave of infection. That said, if we play our cards right, the second wave could be mitigated to a dramatic degree. And again, you're working with different numbers now. You're working from a different starting point. So presuming immunity at least lasts for a bit of time in people, you're working with a smaller vulnerable population that could catch the virus. So that's a positive. But also, if social distancing measures are perhaps only lifted somewhat, some restrictions remain in place, you can still spread out those infections through time. So rather than seeing this awful peak like this, you'll have it. Again, we talk about flattening the curve. So the second wave, if we play our cards right, perhaps won't be so dramatic as the first. But again, until we have a vaccine, you really can't stave off that second without these extreme behavioral measures. In other words, social distancing, staying home, making sure you're staying a decent length away from people on the street, all that sort of thing. Meanwhile, we're going to be watching for that in, for instance, Wuhan, where the outbreak, we believe, began, who has now, the city has finally lifted its social distancing measures. So we'll be seeing if we see a resurgence of cases in China. They projected that if there is a second wave, it would take place perhaps in October, based on current models. We're coming to the end of our live stream, so I think I'm going to answer two more questions. I'm getting a question about positive cases in maternity wards in New York City. So there was a study that came out this week, which we wrote about on LiveScience.com, that suggests that a fair percentage of pregnant women who came into New York City hospitals to give birth recently tested positive for COVID-19 without showing overt symptoms. And this suggests that a high percentage of people in the city have COVID-19 but simply haven't been tested yet. And I think that's a fair thing to say. I don't think you can extrapolate those numbers directly. So seeing the rate of positives among pregnant women are a very specific slice of the population is what I'm trying to say. And those who are giving birth in hospitals in New York City, an even smaller slice of the population. All that said, there's certainly more COVID-19 out in the world than we have recorded in the numbers. So I think that's a good reflection of that trend. Thanks again for submitting all your questions. I do appreciate having so many to choose from. And just to plug our articles once more, many of these are addressed directly on our site. So if you have a question, a lingering question that I didn't get to today, please check out the site and see if it's floating around there already. And if it's not, you can feel free to submit the question to our forums, and it's possible that that can feed back to us and we can attempt to answer that question in an article later on. So I'm getting a question about whether the organ damage associated with a severe COVID-19 infection, whether these are permanent injuries or whether they might heal after some time. So we've seen reports that this organ damage, especially severe organ damage, can linger in patients long after they recover from the actual initial COVID-19 infection. This is extrapolated from studies of people with severe pneumonias in general and other severe viral infections. These types of organ damage can leave people more vulnerable both to infection down the line, but other forms of organ instability, organ failure, in that your body has just had this incredible toll placed on it, and these organs had to work very hard under very difficult conditions for an extended period of time. And that simply leaves them weaker for a period of time afterwards. And depending on what other prior conditions you as an individual might have, depending on how you're able to take care of yourself immediately afterwards. For instance, if you are the type of person who needs to go back to work, or you do something fairly physically exhaustive, all these sort of lifestyle factors as well factor into how the body can recover after infection. If you're able to super take it easy for a while, your recovery rate might be different. But again, it's very dependent on your genetics, your makeup, all these sorts of things. But that said, if you do develop pneumonia at all, but a severe pneumonia or a very severe viral infection, you could feasibly be recovering from that for months to years in terms of how it affects the organs during that brief and intense period of time. So that is a very relevant question. Thank you for asking. I said two more questions, but I'll pick one more. Someone's asking, how long do we have left of all this? When will the pandemic end? And again, my best answer for you is, until we have a vaccine for this thing, it's feasible, it's likely that we'll continue to see waves of infection until we can get it under control. Now, the development of a treatment can help get people in and out of the healthcare system more quickly, more efficiently, get people back on their feet, make it so that people who do develop severe illness fare better and don't place such a strain on resources, but also don't face such dire consequences from contracting the illness. So that's why the development of a treatment is important. But only a vaccine that prevents infection and transmission from an exposed person to an unexposed person can truly snuff out this disease through time. So that's my true answer is, even when we develop the first vaccine that enters public use and becomes approved and seems fairly safe and effective, it might be that vaccine development continues into the future and you see iterative vaccines wherein they keep getting better and better depending on how good the first one is and how much it enhances our immunity to the virus. So we find that live attenuated vaccines tend to be historically the best at granting long-term immunity to viruses, live attenuated vaccines being those that contain a weakened version of the virus that cannot revert back into the disease-causing version of the virus. So these tend to bolster the immune system best. And these naturally take the longest time to make. So this is why I say that you might see multiple rounds of vaccine development. And truly then would be when this would end. And on that note, I'm going to close this week's live stream. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.